It's Wednesday, November 30th, 2016, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me, as always, are my colleagues Mike McKean and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, we'll talk about the coverage of Fidel Castro's death here and abroad. The standoff at Standing Rock continues, yet reporting on it has been relatively shallow. And I also want to ask Mike and Ernest about new developments in the area of fake news. Are the Russians behind it, and could there be connections between Trump cabinet appointments and some of these toxic websites? There's a lot more that hopefully we'll get to as well before our time's up today, but let's start with the latest from the president-elect's Twitter, because it's just not stopping. Yesterday morning, just before 6 a.m., a statement that flag burners should have their citizenship revoked and do jail time. Problem there? That's unconstitutional, and just about everyone knows it. Sunday, a Twitter storm about the Wisconsin recount and renewed claims the election was rigged, complete with totally baseless claims of voter fraud in Virginia, New Hampshire, and California, and that those cost him the popular vote. There's absolutely no evidence to support these claims, and there were a good number of news organizations who had chosen to quote those tweets without that bit of context.
Yeah, I think that's true, but I also think that the news organizations a lot of us respect, the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, CNN, they did say some form of word like baseless or not confirmed or a conspiracy theory or whatever. So there are some news organizations that let it slide, but I think there were others who have found a new center for how they're going to talk about these tweets.
Yeah, you know, they're still trying to feel their way on how they're going to cover President-elect Trump as he moves into the White House. And it sort of goes back to the election campaign where you had, you know, he'd send out these tweets. How do you respond to these tweets? How much time are you going to have to verify them before they start spreading all over social media? And then they're trying to, how much pushback are you going to give, and what kind of impact may that have on access once he does move into the White House?
I thought it was also interesting that the president-elect has gone back to this attacking individual journalists. Mm-hmm. I mean, he went after Jeff Zeleny from CNN. I mean, not just once or twice, multiple tweets. And then he retweeted some 15-year-old fan of the president-elect's who was basically saying it's the media's responsibility to prove that there wasn't fraud rather than the Trump team's responsibility to prove there was. And that's just, I mean, that's like saying that, you know, you're guilty until presumed innocent. That's just not the way it works in this country.
I mean, what's really interesting here is that he's still in campaign mode. Yeah. I mean, even though it's almost as if, you know, he's in campaign mode, but I'm going to hand over the transition to my vice president and to others and let them deal with cabinet appointments and all these things. And I'm going to continue to do the things that I do, which is to tweet, which is to rail against the media, which is to basically make claims that I won the popular vote, these sorts of things. It's amazing how he's been able to compartmentalize the transition, but still sort of hang on to this, I'm in campaign mode.
The timing of some of these, too, is also interesting. And perhaps by interesting, I really mean somewhat circumspect. Because if you look at Sunday's, all about the, once again, claims of a rigged election, Donald Trump once again was able to take back the news cycle after a pretty strongly reported New York Times story about potential business conflicts.
Yeah, and there's this theory that some people, including Jack Schaefer, who writes about the media at Politico, is thinking that, you know, he's sort of this evil genius mastermind who is using Twitter as a way to keep the media from focusing on the bad stories.
Walking and chewing gum thing again.
I'm not so sure that I buy that, okay. But I have a variant theory of my own, which is basically there are a lot of people that think that the president-elect is just disorganized or inexperienced or shoots from the hip. I think this is a strategy. I think he thrives on chaos, and especially he thrives on jerking the media's chain so that we don't really know where he's coming from at any one moment.
I mean, to me, he's a modern day Joseph McCarthy. He understands how the media works and he uses it to his advantage. He knows that if I give them this, it's going to become clickbait. They're going to go after it. They're going to put it up there. And once it's up there the way I want it to be up there, then it works to my advantage, even if they decide at some point, oh, we're going to put that this is flawed, or we're going to put that this is a misrepresentation. Well, it's already out there, and I've already gotten my half a day or a couple of hours of the story and the narrative that I want it to be, and I'm good with that. And then he moves on to something else.
I may be dating myself and maybe some of our audience who get this reference, but do either of you remember the Saturday Night Live routine? It was a classic one from like 1986 where President Ronald Reagan, who's being played by Phil Hartman, is acting really clueless and with a reporter interviewing. And then when the reporter leaves the room or the Girl Scout leaves the room, all of a sudden he's this mad genius who understands everything about government and can do complex math problems in his head and all that. It kind of makes me think about Trump, maybe not as a super mastermind, but I think he has a strategy, and it's not just a strategy with the media. I think it's also with lobbyists and with Congress and other people who might try to pin him down on what he does or doesn't want to do. Because if he can keep everybody guessing, he might have an easier time of getting through some of the things he really wants to do. And we don't know what those things are.
We don't know what those things are.
Well, meanwhile, the talk about fake news isn't going anywhere either. If anything, it's ramping up. And there's a theory out there that the Russians are behind it. Break this one down for us.
Well, I mean, the whole issue with fake news, and we have a story on our Links blog that talks about this, is that all of a sudden people are thinking that this is something new. It's not. This is all a part of how propaganda news works, and it's always worked this way, is that you're giving people news and information that fits their biases, that fits what they believe, and you use that. When it comes to, and it's the story that we have in the Links blog, talks about this, when it comes to other things like the weather or sports, if you did this, it would be immediately refuted, and the facts would be out there, and everybody would gravitate toward that. When it comes to political news, which is what we're talking about here, they've been able to sort of take what's always been done from a historical perspective and move it into the 21st century and ramp it up. Now, whether or not the Russians are involved, or the Iranians, and now they're talking about maybe ISIS is involved. I read that this morning in some of this fake news. Does it really matter whether they're involved or not? People are buying into it because it fits their biases.
You know, I'm of a couple of minds about this focus on fake news. I mean, I think it's a real problem, and I think, you know, it hurts real people. You had a link to a story about this pizzeria in Washington. I mean, it's making money for people.
It's making money.
Which is propagating this, you know. It's people close to Trump reportedly have also been involved in it, but so have the Russians allegedly been involved with. So all these different facets. My only concern is I hope that those of us in the news media don't keep talking about fake news as somehow absolving us from taking a critical look at what we didn't do well, right? And I could say more about that, but I worry.
Then go for it.
Well, so for example, you know, I think we all agreed that the news media didn't do a very good job of understanding the people who voted for Trump. We tended to stereotype them, and there are racists and sexists and homophobes and xenophobes who voted for Trump. But there's a whole lot of other people who did too. And I don't think that we've done a very good job of trying to figure out how to understand their stories and put those stories into context.
Had a story either yesterday or the day before that was actually pretty good about that you can go to our link.
But and I think that those have been, I won't say the exception, but there haven't been enough of those stories yet.
Yeah.
And if the media just decide that we are going to blame everybody but ourselves, we'll be doing ourselves and the public a disservice.
And I think by focusing in on this the fake news, all of a sudden you make it a real story. You give it more cachet than it actually needs. We need to be out there basically telling the public this is what the story is. And it sort of goes back to what we were talking about with the Twitter. Mm-hmm. If the president-elect or anyone else out there is putting out false information on their Twitter feed, we need to call it false from the beginning and not let it just go out there and become its own narrative before we can come back and backtrack on it.
My worry about that is that no matter how good a job traditional journalists do of pointing out fake news and calling people to account for it, we could be overwhelmed by the fact that these sites are followed by more people than follow the New York Times or the Washington Post or whatever online.
And the part of that, again, to come back to this story about this pizza parlor in D.C. where a fake news site had said that a child trafficking ring was being run through the basement of that pizza parlor. Incidentally, it doesn't have a basement. But that Hillary Clinton and the Democratic Party were running a child trafficking ring in the basement. We are then basically spending our time as reporters proving a negative.
Right.
As opposed to doing real reporting.
And this goes back to Mike's point, is that, you know, when we're running around chasing these stories instead of talking about the real issues, we're losing sight of the voters and the constituents that Mike was talking about, because they are concerned about real issues that affect them on a daily basis and not this other thing. But if we spend so much time on that, we lose sight of that.
I do think there are a couple of things that the news media can and should be doing besides just pointing out on an ad hoc basis whether this story is true or not. I mean, one, we need to somehow find a way to get involved in effective media literacy training, because this is a long-term problem. And we've said that for many, many years, but it's a long-term problem. And the other thing I think we could do right away, and some news organizations are beginning to think about this, on our websites, we run a lot of this programmatic advertising that turns up this fake news content on our very own legitimate sites. Mm-hmm. So we're kind of breaking down the barriers ourselves because it brings in a little bit of revenue. We need to stop doing that.
Okay, well, we were off last week for the Thanksgiving holiday, so there was some pretty big news that we didn't get a chance to talk about. So I'm going to ask the two of you for your reactions to it. Now, the president-elect's meetings at Trump Tower, that off-the-record one with TV news execs and anchors, and the on-the-record one with the New York Times, both of these made so many headlines. It's hard to decide which one to ask you about first. So which one in your mind created more impact for the greater number of people?
I think the one that the greater number of people would have been the New York Times, because they basically laid the groundwork for how the newspaper of record, the newspaper that I believe is going to be the national newspaper at some point, they laid the groundwork for how they're going to deal with the Trump administration. We're going to be on the record with everything. We're not going to give you the opportunity to go off the record and just basically run the narrative the way you want to. And and the question becomes, are the other news outlets out there, in particular, the television news outlets, going to follow suit? That didn't happen when they met with them, because they all decided that they would meet off record, and it turned into a fiasco.
Do you think part of that was because that was the first meeting? When you say follow suit, like the idea of which meeting was first.
Well, I think part of it was that they thought, well, okay, if we can do it now and create some sort of dialogue with him, closed door and come to some sort of agreement, then we know which direction we're going. Why would you think Donald Trump was going to do that? He hadn't done it in the 18 months that he was running this campaign. He's never done it in the way in which he's dealt with the press throughout his entire career. What makes you think he was going to do it at that point? I don't get it.
This is just speculation, and we don't obviously know what was inside the heads of the TV anchors and the executives, but I think it would be fair to suggest that he basically stroked their egos, and then he had them. Mm-hmm. I mean, he basically, you know, you get to come in first, and the big anchors get to talk to me first, and oh, all you have to do is make it an off-the-record conversation so that we can get to know each other. And then what happened? We assume, we don't know, but we assume that he dressed them down. Why do we assume that? Because people in the Trump camp leaked it to the New York Post and other people that he dressed them down. After that, after he'd broken the off-the-record part of this, then some of the journalists in the room, I guess, started leaking too. But by then, the narrative had already been established all around the world, amplified by social media, that he got the TV network folks and he told them, you haven't been fair and this is how it's going to be going forward. That was a mistake, a really strategic mistake on the broadcaster's part. I will say also, you know, you asked about the New York Times, mm-hmm. and I agree with Ernest that I think that they did a better service by sticking to their guns and by saying, now, not all of it was on the record.
That's
there
true.
Was a meeting with the publisher that was off the record, and there was, I read the transcript, there was one question that was asked about the president-elect's supposed policy for dealing with ISIS that was also off the record. But, I mean, other than that, look, they got some couple of pretty big scoops on that. Donald Trump saying that maybe climate change might possibly be partially human-made, right?
Yeah.
He he
backtracked a little bit on immigration.
He backtracked a little bit on Hillary Clinton, his business dealings. The only thing I would say about that is Trump manipulated the times too. I mean, from, well, I was going to meet with you, but no, I'm not, because, you know, you changed the rules of the game. Oh, I'll come back and talk to you, and I'm going to lambaste you on with one hand, and then I'm going to say that you're a, what is it, a world jewel or something like that. And I doubt that he went in there and just the times somehow managed to extract from him all these changes in policy. He came in there knowing what he wanted to say.
Oh, no, I agree with you totally on that, but I think the ground rules were set by the New York Times as to how they're going to deal with him. And that, to me, is the important part. The question is, how, to me, is how's the television executives going to do that now that they've gone this route? Are you going to pretty much follow the New York Times, or are you going to try to come up with some other way of doing it? I think a lot of this revolves around access and whether or not Donald Trump is going to play by the rules that other presidents have played by. I don't think he will. I think he is not going to play by those rules. He's given indications that he's not going to do that. And until otherwise, I, as a journalist, until otherwise, he can't be trusted.
I hate to say it too, but I worry that the TV anchors and TV news executives still are worried a little too much about the ratings, because, you know, what they want from a President Trump is regular exclusive access for doing interviews with him that they can promote. Mm-hmm. They know that he made a lot of money for them in the campaign. And if they don't back away from that really narrow concern, I worry for them.
Well, how often we end up sitting here at this table and talk about the need for diversity in our reporting, to know and to understand our communities and the effects that business and industry and politics have on them. Well, shame on us, because journalists across the country have been so obsessed the last few months with the election and its aftermath that we've almost completely ignored a story with huge implications on one of the most undercovered groups in our nation, the standoff at Standing Rock Reservation and the Native Americans fighting to stop the Dakota Access Pipeline. A lot of the reporting that we have seen has made it seem like this is an issue that affects one Native American tribe, not the millions of people who live along the banks of the Missouri River.
I think what this goes back to what we talk about on the show all the time, which is context. And I think part of the issue goes directly to what you just said, is that it affects a lot of people, but the narrowness in which we're covering it, if we cover it at all, focuses on this particular group of Native Americans and this particular company. But what it's really talking about is access and land access on reservations that are controlled by these groups. And the government not living up to its part of the responsibility and making sure that those lands are protected based on the treaties that were signed by the government and these tribes way back in the 1880s.
I first of all agree completely with your premise that the media just ignored this story, generally speaking, other than the local media.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And some specialized media that had certain access to grind. I mean, I think that we didn't do a very good job in the traditional media of covering this story at all. Now that we're on it, I'm worried about another problem. And that's that it's going to be just like our coverage, all kinds of other stories. It's going to be political. It's going to be ideologically driven. I mean, if you think about it.
Lack context.
If you look at the sort of the media that have been there early, like Democracy Now! And some others who were sympathetic with the Native American tribes and environmentalists, they play up that angle of the story. They play down the violence toward police officers and law enforcement. Mm-hmm. If you're on the conservative side of this and you're covering it, it's all about law and order and energy and jobs, and you downplay, you know, the way law enforcement may have been mistreating the Native Americans and other protesters there. Could somebody please take a big picture look? And I'll suggest, if you want to do that, start out by reading the local newspaper, the Bismarck Tribune in North Dakota. I think that they've done a pretty decent job, from what I've been able to tell, of providing in-depth and balanced coverage. And that's what you would expect from a local news organization whose audience is going to be the most affected by the story.
I mean, to me, that's the best way to cover the story. I think if the national media, if and when they decide that they're going to cover it that way, mm-hmm. need to be looking at it, not just about what's happening on the ground there, but what are the policies that have come out of the Capitol in that state and out of Washington, D.C. that led to where we are right now.
So is that even something that is possible at this point? This has been going on since April. For the national media to parachute in at this point Is it a recoverable type of a story at the level you're talking about?
It depends on how you parachute in. If you parachute in and just talk about the events that are happening on the ground, then you're not telling the full story. Go ahead, Mark.
No, I'm sorry. And if you parachute in and the only people you talk to are the usual suspects who've already dominated the news cycle for those folks who have covered it, if you're just going to do that and you're just going to put it as a typical conflict story, they say this, they say that, and you don't get into the details, why even bother?
Why even bother?
Okay, well, I was sound asleep Friday night, sometime around 11:30, maybe it was 12:30, I don't remember, but my phone rang, and it was my dad. He wanted to wake me up and tell me Fidel Castro had died. I flipped on CNN and drifted in and out of sleep throughout the night, listening to the coverage as it continued. And it seemed surreal to me, especially in those early hours, that they kept reporting that CNN, being one of the few, if not only, American news organizations to have a full-time correspondent in Havana, that it hadn't officially been announced in Cuba yet that he had died, yet we were hearing about it in the United States.
I mean, it's my impression that that's one of the reasons that CNN got off to a pretty good start on this story. I think you have a link on our blog, too, about the Miami Herald, who's been planning for this story for like 20 years.
Yeah, if not longer.
And of course, they have a Cuban-American community in Miami that they can tap into for a lot more context and background. Both of those news organizations did a pretty good job, I'd say. So again, if we want to talk about criticizing how the media might have covered this, there are a lot of folks who say, again, that we don't put it into context or whatever. And I buy that argument, but I also don't think that American media, despite our long history with Cuba, should shy away from saying this man was a dictator. This man killed and repressed and jailed people. He ruined his economy, except for a little help from Russia at one point in Venezuela. It would be even worse off than it is now. That doesn't mean we can't provide the context about their healthcare system and Castro's efforts to bring up the literacy rate in his country. I mean, you can talk about both of those things, but saying you need to provide context or that Americans are somehow biased shouldn't keep us from talking about what this man did in his country to his people.
Yeah, and I wonder if, I kind of noticed that too in the coverage, but I wonder if the normalization of relations between the United States and Cuba is sort of having an impact on that coverage.
If that's going to continue to happen.
If that's going to continue to happen.
The normalization, and you mean.
The right. Normalization. Okay. Normalization, yeah. And that's what sort of got me wondering whether or not our coverage of Castro's death is sort of clouded in what's happened there in the last year in terms of U.S.-Cuban relationships, because I do think that we really need to do a better job of playing out exactly what happened during his reign from the time that he took over all the way up to the point that we're at now.
Especially, frankly, for people of my generation or those who are younger I remember basically the very tail end of the Cold War and grew up knowing, you know, that Castro guy, he was a bad guy. But for people who are older than me, there's a completely different perspective because we didn't live through the Bay of Pigs. We didn't live through the Cuban Missile Crisis. Okay. We didn't, you know, hide under our desks. Those air raid sirens to us are tornado sirens. And I think a lot of that history, that background, that context wasn't necessarily there as deeply as it could have been for the benefit of people who are in their teens or 20s or 30s.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, and part that's missing from the stories that you're reading is that.
I mean, I spent a lot of Saturday looking for that.
Right. Well, I mean, and the Miami Herald had a lot of that because they had tapped into that community, mm-hmm. and so you got a lot of that history from those stories because there were people who were dancing in the streets and cheering at his death because of all of that history that you're talking about, and that story needed to be told, as well as a story about how Cubans felt or feeling about what's just happened.
So, Ernest, I saw some criticism of the Miami Herald and help either defend or, I don't know, chastise the editors there. People who were upset that when they picked up their print edition on Saturday morning, there wasn't a Fidel Castro is dead headline on the front of Saturday's paper, that there wasn't a super late night run on the print publication. in this case, given that like break glass plan that had been in place for 20-25 years.
They missed an opportunity. I mean, that's the only way you can explain it, is that they missed an opportunity to do it, especially because of that large Cuban presence in Miami.
I will make a plug for the Miami Herald, for as much as I may have just thrown them under the bus on that one. They do have an online presence, and this has been one of my absolute favorite multimedia projects going back close to a decade. It's called Operation Pedropon, and I will go ahead and link that on the links blog as well, where they have built an online community of children who were evacuated from Cuba and connected them across the United States and continue to build that community today.
I think what's nice, too, is that there is a smallish group of journalists mm-hmm. who are the children of the parents yeah. who were exiled from Cuba. And they have a really interesting perspective because they can tell it personally, but they also have the journalistic chops to know how to put it all into
context. In fact, one of my classmates here, who is now a reporter at the NBC station in Miami, I believe is a grandchild of a Cuban immigrant. Yeah. Well, before we go, I want to talk quickly about a story that was in the New York Times about some engineering going on at Facebook that may let the social network climb over the Great Firewall and once again be a allowed in China. It's a tool that would allow censorship. And if it does, it's going to open up a whole new market for China, or for Facebook, I mean.
I find this really ironic. I mean, I've spent a fair amount of time in the last 10 years yeah. in China doing trade training and watching the media there. And it's interesting because you have a situation where Facebook is basically, if you believe these accounts, ready to bend over backwards to pre-censor content before it gets out to people on Facebook as a condition for doing business in China. That's really interesting to me because China has its own social media that are very, very powerful.
And I wanted to bring up this idea of WeChat, which is a Chinese social network, Mike, that you and I are both on, and it can only be described as Facebook on steroids.
Well, and in fact, the company that owns WeChat, called Tencent, also owns QQ and Qzone. And the three of those are three of the five biggest social media platforms in the world. And although the Great Firewall in China is real, it's very hard to get past the government censors. There still is sort of this, I would say, wink and a nod between the government and Tencent that certain conversations can occur there. It's almost like a safety valve to, you know, avoid more protests against the government. So isn't it ironic that there's kind of this place for free expression on a Chinese government-supported or sanctioned company, while here comes Facebook ready to ride in and for more audience be willing to give up free expression?
I wonder whether or not this has more to do with economics than anything else.
That's what I'm thinking. This is about an untapped market for a company whose growth has become rather stagnant.
Right, right. And the question to me is, what's going to be the kickback to China? Because they're just not going to let them in and say, hey, you can take this market and make all this money and we not get a cut.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, that music means we're pretty much out of time for this week. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. You can read more about each of the topics we talked about today on our links blog. That's under the programs tab at kbia.org. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @viewsonkbia. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again, to leave us comments or questions, see previews of what we'll be talking about next week, and more. Our thanks to Travis McMillan for directing today's show and to Pat Akers for handling the audio. I'm Amy Simons. Be sure to join us again next week when we're back with you for another edition of Views of the News.